item in the which is a policy item only. So we will do a strange procedure. It's kind of new this year. We will adjourn as a policy division and reconvene as a adjourn as a budget division, reconvene as a policy committee to consider Senate File 653. So to begin with today, and I have some announcements to make, but I want to wait till a few more members are here. We're going to start with a presentation by the Office of Higher Education on some work they've been doing on tuition costs in Minnesota before we hear a series of tuition bills. Okay, welcome.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Mark Mishkanis, for the record. I'm with the Office of Higher Education.
And my name is Cheryl Mapplethorpe, also with the Office of Higher Education.
And Madam Chair and members, I understand that you want us to be relatively brief. Mm-hmm. We do have some slides both on tuition and a few things related to aid. If that's inappropriate, we can skip over those. We'll watch for your advice on those.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, you do have a set of these slides in your packets, I believe. The first one simply shows tuition increases adjusted for inflation at the three public systems going back to 1971 through 2007. The source of this is actually the Higher Education Coordinating Board in Washington. Odd as it may sound, they collect data nationally, so we, for comparability purposes, we do use theirs as a base. The university may differ a bit with these numbers, but we get them from them in the first place and then respond to this entity, so they should be about the same. In any event, the trends wouldn't be any different. Three points to make. This data, to the extent that it's not flat, means that tuition is increasing faster than the rate of inflation. We're using the CPI as a deflator. You can see through the early 80s it was relatively flat for the three systems, some incline up from that period of time up through 2003, and then much more dramatic changes relative to inflation, especially at the University of Minnesota since that period. I'll move on to the next chart then, Madam Chair. This shows the private colleges. Actually, this is the private college council figures, so it includes only their membership, but it's a published data, so it's something that we use. Again, it's adjusted for inflation. The reason we have it on a separate graph is because given it's the fact that it's much higher, would have an impact on comparing it to the public's. In any event, though, you see the same kind of strange pattern. Through the early 80, up through 83, that first 12-year period, it's relatively flat compared to inflation and has increased steadily since that period of time. And it's not quite clear to me why that would have occurred. It's simply the historical data. Madam Chair, using that same set of same information source for some comparisons to other states. Let me talk about I'll go through these line by line. The first three are from the Washington Higher Education Coordinating Board study, and then the second two are from the IPEDS data, or the last two. But the University of Minnesota, you can see the tuition and fees. These are required fees only, not any additional that may come for particular classes. Compared to the national average, it's roughly $28 higher. We rank eighth in the country in the survey out of 50 states that do supply information. The comprehensive public 4 years, essentially the Minsky institutions, if you will. You can see that the difference between the two is much smaller, about $450. The ranking here is a bit lower at 15th. And again, this is out of 50 states. The community colleges, as a national comparison, is the one that I think it stands out the most as a dramatic difference from the national average, quite a bit higher, and we do rank third in the country. Next to, I believe, was Vermont and, I'm sorry, New Hampshire.
Wisconsin.
And Wisconsin, second on that list. And then the two-year the next line is the four-year not-for-profits. Again, you expect these to be higher, but the difference between the schools in this state and nationally, this would include all of the not-for-profits, not just those in the private college council group, about $2,100 higher, ranking 10th in the country out of 49 states. And then finally, the two-year for-profit.
Okay, thanks.
The difference there is roughly $1,000, a bit less, ranking 14th. and out of 43 states. Just another, a couple other points, Madam Chair, if I may, things that you don't have on the document you have, but I'll simply note them for your purposes. Again, this goes back to the Washington Higher Education Study. This was just released in January, so it's relatively new information. For the comprehensive colleges, a four-year tuition increases over the last 4 years. In Minnesota, it has been 42.5% compared to an average of 38.9%. 16 states in the country were higher than Minnesota's, and the remainder were below that average increase. For the community colleges, the same numbers. In Minnesota, over the last 4 years, tuition and fee increases were 40.5%. This compares to an average of 33% for the rest of the country. However, 12 states had increases higher than in Minnesota, and the remainder had increases lower. And then finally, for the flagship institutions, and at this level, the comparison is not between states, but between different institutions in the study. The rate at the Twin City campus, University of Minnesota, was 50%. 9 states were higher, 15 were lower. The 50% compares to a national average of about 48%. So not out of line with the rest of the country, I think, is kind of the message from these. No one likes high tuition rates, but everybody seems to be facing them.
You know, Ms. Akonis, I know over the last 4 or 5 years that we've cut our appropriations to Minsky and the University of Minnesota because of the budget shortfall we had, but that doesn't quite explain the private colleges being at such a steep curve. We'll have to ask them.
I noted that as well, Madam Chair.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Dr. and Ms. Akonis, does the tuition and fees include textbook costs?
Mr. Miskanis,
Madam Chair, Senator Wigger, no, they're not considered required fees. These are simply the required fees include only those that apply to every student, so anything outside those, like textbooks, would not be included.
Madam Chair, is it common sense to conclude that if you're enrolled in a class, it's a good idea to get the textbook?
Mr. Miskanis.
Madam Chair, Senator Wigger, I certainly would hope so as a good student, but
as a professor?
In this case, I actually use the internet and don't require textbooks anymore. But Senator Wigger, I think you asked, I understand the point you're making there about the textbook costs. I think part of the problem is that they differ so much across students. Certainly in a chemistry class, you'd be expected to pay a lot more for textbooks than something else.
Well, Madam Chair and committee members, I would suggest that the cost for average tuition and fees should have an escalator of another 15 or 16%. Based on fixed costs that students have.
Is that a question?
Not sure.
He may react if he wants.
Oh. No, well, Madam Chair and Senator Wigger, I think you intend to hear the textbook study from us in the next while.
There's no. I think it may be on our schedule Friday.
Well,
or
Madam Chair, I know that is to come, but we're discussing tuition and fees, the cost of higher education. And my point for the record is that this is a part of what you pay for, and indeed it is a fixed cost for the overwhelming majority of students. So when we look at a chart showing how much it costs to go to school, we should be transparent about the full cost.
Madam Chair, just a note, I think Senator Wigger, I think actually that, as you may find from the results of that study, that the rate of inflation in textbooks is below that of tuition. So it would tend to actually bring these numbers down should you include those. But again, as a share of the total cost, it is relatively, not unimportant, of course, but much smaller than tuitions or room and board, things like that.
Okay, continue.
Okay, Madam Chair, then, the remainder has to do with financial aid. And again, I'd look to you for advice.
Well, I think you could go through it quickly.
Okay.
Because I think we'll come back to the financial aid stuff at a later date.
It is of an overview nature, so I think mm-hmm. the extent that helps you later on, that's helpful. The chart you have in front of you, Madam Chair, simply shows the increase in state appropriation for financial aid. Going back about 18 years, you can see most of that both the direction and the general shape is driven by the state grant appropriation itself. As you know, though, there's a number of other aid programs, state grant, work study. I'm sorry, in addition to the state grant, it's work study, post-secondary child care, and the others listed there that lead to that total. And again, this is in current dollars. This is not adjusted for inflation.
Okay, I think you can skip to number 10.
Does that mean go through the state grant?
Pass this, Madam Chair.
What does number 10 look like?
State 10. Grant is need-based. That's number 10, right?
That's number 10. You want to spend a few minutes with this, then, Madam Chair?
Beg your pardon?
Did you want to spend a few minutes with this chart?
Yeah.
Okay.
We can talk about this.
All right. This page, again, this is Cheryl Mapplethorpe from the Office of Higher Education. This is a picture of the number of recipients of the state grant, and you can see that the majority of the recipients are towards the lower income ranges, and then as we go up towards $70,000, we get fewer and fewer recipients in the state grant. If you go to the next page, it gives...
Ms. Mapplethorpe, do you know off the top of your head then where the Pell Grant cuts off in terms of adjusted gross income?
The Pell Grant for a family of four will cut off around $38,000 or so, depending on the assets of the family.
Okay.
The page that we're looking at now gives information about the Pell Grant, the state grant, and another federal grant called SEOG, Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant. You may be more familiar with the Pell Grant and state grant. Pell Grant, as you can see, the average award does not change based on the price of the institution. It's not sensitive to price. The state grant, on the other hand, leverages on top of the Pell Grant and does change according to the price of the institution. If it's a lower-cost institution, it'll be a smaller amount, and then it will increase as the price goes up. Keep in mind that there is a maximum tuition that's counted for a four-year program and a maximum tuition counted for the two-year program, which is why you see a lower amount in the private career schools, even though the price is higher. Then if you go down to the very bottom line, that's SEOG. SEOG is federal money, which is given as a block grant to the institutions. So each institution has a certain amount of that. Once they run out of that money, it's gone. But the institution does have the ability to select the students that they want to give that award to. It's part of the aid package, so it is constrained by the total aid package. Therefore, if you're at a lower-priced institution, that, in theory, would be a smaller amount of the award because generally they will give the Pell Grant first. On top of that, they'll build the state grant, and then on top of that, they'll build the SEOG and institutional money.
Yeah, I've never heard of that. Is it a needs-based grant or a merit-based?
Yes. SEOG is a federal grant. It's need-based. The federal government changes the rules every now and then, but basically you are supposed to be eligible for the Pell Grant in order to get the SEOG.
Okay.
If we go to the next page, it shows the grants awarded in Minnesota and the loans awarded in Minnesota. These are total amounts. We collect this information every 2 years. You can see what it was in 2003 and then again in 2005, and we've got the percent changes there. If you go to the next page, it shows the financial aid by type, grants, loans, parent loans, and work study. Let me just make the comment that the grant line is the federal grant, the state grant, and institutional grants. And as you can see, the expansion of grants, a lot of that expansion comes from the increase in institutional grants, not in the Pell Grant or the state grant. If you turn the page again, you'll see the sources of money, and those sources are federal, state, and institution. Keep in mind that when you're seeing an increase in that top line for the federal government, most of that increase is an increase in loan, not an increase in grant. And that's the overview. If you have any questions.
Do you have any, has there been any research, do you know, as to why there's an increase in private student loans, but the federal student loans is a much smaller increase? Ms. Mapplethorpe.
Private loans are considered alternative loans or supplementary loans. They come from the banking industry. So the federal government has a standard loan which remains fairly stable from year to year, but the other loans are from the banking industry, and they can create a loan anytime they want to.
So does this include credit card debt, or it's
no.
specifically an educational loan?
It's specifically an educational loan, Madam Chair.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
On that, grants from private sources, are those income-based? Are those income-based, or they have other criteria?
Ms. Mapplethorpe.
Generally, grants from other sources, if it's from the federal government, it will be need-based. If it's from the state, it will be need-based. If it's from the institution can award that money any way they would like to. Many institutions use more of a merit-based. They might have need-based component and merit-based. It might be based on some special skill, like they're good at playing the flute, or it might be a higher grade point.
Yeah, Madam Chair,
and
the grants from private sources was the one I was asking about specifically.
Oh, Madam Chair and members, the grants from private sources can be based on whatever that private source would like to fund. There are, for instance, some hometowns that have hometown scholarships that will give scholarships to their senior graduates from their own hometown, or different nationalities, different races. It can be based on whatever the private source would like.
So if we go back and we look at Minnesota's community college tuition, which is $4,200, what's the total here in terms of grant money? So if a student got all three of those grants, they would be almost there to the total of the tuition, be at about $3,700. Just be short about $500.
Yeah.
I had a bill a few years ago that would have fully funded that. It was $500. That's right.
I voted for it.
Okay, you voted for it. I'm
yes,
sure you did. Okay. Do you have more slides you're showing us?
Madam Chair, no, but members, there is another handout that you have. It's a one-page handout. It's financial aid. It has
okay.
much more detail on where these aggregates come from for 2005. So it'll give you a better sense of the variety of sources that go into the financial aid numbers.
Great. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much for that very brief overview. Sorry to rush you since we have such a busy agenda. We're going to hear the bills about tuition increase limitations, so maybe we could ask Senator Gerlach and Senator Rosen to come to the table. I had some announcements to make. Remember that those of you who are on the Region Selection Committee, we're meeting tonight at 6:30 and Room 5 of the State Office Building. Tomorrow night, we'll be having a meeting at the Rondo Community Center from 6:30 to 8:30. That'll be an official hearing to hear from students as to their interests and aspirations and concerns about college, as well as hearing from the St. Paul schools about what they're doing to get their kids ready for college. On Thursday, we'll be adjourning at 2:30, so members may attend President Brunick's State of the University address at Kauffman Union. Senator Lynch and I are going for sure, and if anybody else wants to carpool over there, they have arranged for some parking for us. So we'll leave at 2:30. If you want to go, it's optional. We'll adjourn at 2:30, and then we can carpool, and the State of the University address is at 3. That's in Kauffman Union. And I went last year, and it was a lot of fun. And okay. Then we have several bills. Senator Day could not be with us, but he just asked us to consider his bill in the mix. with Senator Gerlach and Senator Rosen. Do you want to make some opening comments?
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the invited to the committee and get a hearing on the bill. And I appreciate certainly you packing the house for me today for my bill.
I'm sure if they could get into college, they'd like a stable tuition.
Yes. I have a couple of ideas here. Now, I don't serve on this committee, and I'm certainly no expert in a lot of the issues you've all been wrestling with and how to make college and higher education more accessible and affordable. But I want to tell you about the source of this bill here and where it came from, why do I have an interest in this, and then tell you a little bit about what the bill is not, because you've heard a lot of different ideas and proposals over the past years, and then I want to tell you what this bill potentially could do, and then it's my understanding, Madam Chair, that that we're not going to be voting on this bill. It's information, and you can lay this over then for some deliberations with the committee as you put together the omnibus bill. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, let me just tell you the source of this notion here. Came to me last year. I submitted throughout my district a flyer to
Gerlach,
schools.
Which bill are you talking about?
I'm sorry. I'm starting with 598.
598. Okay.
Did you, since we're doing this for information, does it need to be moved?
No.
Okay. Senate File 598, dealing with a strategy to guarantee a tuition rate or have a stabilization of tuition. And I submitted a flyer out to schools, and I asked students, I said, you can change the law. What are your ideas? And I collected a whole range of ideas. Some of them were good. Some of them were not so good. But one of them that particularly caught my eye was from a student named Katie Shaw, who's now a freshman at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she was a senior at the School of Environmental Studies in Apple Valley, and she said, we need some kind of predictability. I need to know, I know that the rising tuition is a big issue, but I need some predictability and stability, and can we do something about that? So we talked about that, and we got together and crafted up a bill, and we did some research on other states, what they're doing on this. And what you have before you is a bill that was introduced last year, later in the session, and we did get an informational hearing in the House on this, and that's why I'm appreciative that we were able to hear this before the deadlines this year, so we can deliberate this. And the notion, let me tell you first of all what this bill is not. This bill is not a typical tuition freeze bill. It's not just simply saying you can't charge any more for tuition, because in my mind that's really a simplistic price control, and that's just going to squeeze out somewhere else. Doesn't really help anybody in the long run. I think it's just a shift. This is not a prepaid plan. Those are readily available. If you do an internet search of tuition plans, you can find that there are a lot of prepaid plans where you can simply write a very large check up front, and I assume that that's invested by the institution over 4 years, and they can offset some of the rises there. Unfortunately, I think prepaid plans really don't help middle-income or low-income people, because you've got to have a large lump sum up front, so that's not what this bill is about. It's not what the bill goes after or tries to help. This bill is about stabilization and predictability. It also, as a side benefit, I think can offer some incentives to finish work on time and finish within a 4 or potentially maybe maximum of 5-year time frame. And how does it work? This is the concept. We know we can predict to a reasonable extent what tuition is going to be. And the idea is that when a student enters in a cohort in a freshman class or into a Minsky universe or setting here, they are going to, the institution would look ahead and say, if you make a commitment to this institution, we will be able to guarantee you a rate of tuition for 4 year, or in this particular case is 5 year in the bill, but I'm not wedded to that. It could certainly be 5 or 4 years, but a time frame whereby tuition is not going to run away from you, so that you won't have to start with your part-time job and then in the middle of your sophomore year face dropping out because the rate is getting away from you, or your parents can't afford to keep up with the costs. Those sorts of things, once you've started and committed to a program, committed to an institution. The problem this is trying to get after is that predictability and that stabilization. So you'll have a lock-in time by the institution, who have smart people who can figure out what that's going to be, what the rate needs to be. Now, naturally, that means that a freshman class is going to have a little higher hurdle on the front end, but that you'll gain in the out years. That is a natural aspect of this plan. But to limit that a little bit, in the proposal I have, we do allow for an inflationary increase. And I know that this is an issue that with a lot of members who I've spoken to on the committee, that if it's just hard saying lock it in, that you might have a little heartburn about that because, you know, you need a little escape valve there. So I think adding inflation, allowing for some reasonable index of inflation makes sense. So in the bill before you, there is a provision to allow for some inflation adjustments. And we picked, there's a lot of different CPIs you can choose from. We picked the Consumer Price Index for Urban Consumers that was prepared by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Federal Bureau. And so allowing for that can help, you know, people, I think, expect inflation. They don't expect double digit. And so this can help to do that. So the question comes up, well, what else is happening around the country? Who else is doing things on this? And what I discovered in doing some research last year, and it's held true this year as well, Southern Illinois University, Carbondale, has a guaranteed tuition stabilization plan. And in their literature, it says it was developed in an attempt to address the concern that students and their families need to be able to plan for the cost of tuition. And that is a critical element here. There is a write-up of details of their plan, and I don't know really how much needs to be legislated and how much needs to be left up to the institutions. I think if this idea carries some weight and has some momentum to it, I think that you're wiser than I on that and might be able to figure out what can be left to the institutions to figure out. In this particular case, this was passed by the Illinois State Legislature and was mandated to their institution. There are other cases where that was not the case, where the institutions just did it on their own. The University of Texas in Dallas says there was an article on February 12th, just a couple weeks ago, says UTD will join a handful of colleges and universities across the country that guarantee new students fixed tuition and fees for a period of 4 academic years starting in the fall of 07. It says their plan is designed to help students and their families better plan for the cost of a college education while allowing the university to maintain the quality of its academic programs. Of course, that aspect is very important to the institutions. And this was stated by David Daniel, the president of the university. And the interesting thing is that Mr. Professor Daniel, or Dr. Daniel, came there to that school from the University of Illinois and had experience in implementing a plan like this. He also goes on to say this will reassure new students and their parents committing to UTD that education costs will not go up for 4 years thereafter. It says it will provide also an incentive for students to earn a degree in a timely manner, and it does say that Dr. Daniel earlier worked at the University of Illinois, which was ordered by the government to implement the guaranteed tuition plan. Among other states that are doing things are other universities offering guaranteed tuition plans are University of Illinois, University of Kansas, Baylor, Vanderbilt, and George Washington University. I think that it's an attempt across the country to help deal with some aspect of stabilizing and predictability here. And again, this does not tackle the larger issue you have of controlling the costs, but it helps, I think, with one angle to the dilemma. I think it's worthy of discussion, and I appreciate the opportunity to present the idea. There is a second bill I have on here. I should say that this particular bill we're addressing is co-authored in the House by Representative Rob Eastland. He also co-authored with me last year. There is another bill, House or Senate File 232, which is co-authored by Representative Mark Biskins in the House, and it is essentially his take on it, and I agreed to introduce it as well. I think it's certainly a valid argument. He says that we don't need to put in a bill, you need to allow for inflation. He said just leave everything, all the details up to the institution, and just tell them to come up with a guaranteed plan. So there's different schools of thought on that. I don't need to go into all this detail on the second bill. I think we can save some time there. But that's essentially the gist of the difference between the two bills. And I also would like to say Senate File 456, Senator Day's bill, it's the same as the one that I've been speaking to, the Senate File 598. He is also very concerned about this issue. He and I have spoken about this, and he couldn't be here to testify on this bill. So he wanted to make sure, as you stated, that his bill was in the mix as well. So with that, Madam Chair, I think that that gets to the gist of it, the idea, the concept behind it. I'm not necessarily wedded to all of the details. In fact, I'll give you a little story here on the time frame. We discussed whether it should be 5 years or 4 years. Well, I thought initially, well, it should be 4 years. After all, that is a college or university length of to earn an undergraduate degree. I asked around all the legislative assistants in the area who recently were college graduates, and I said, what should the number be? And they all said 5. And I acquiesced, and I said, okay, 5. In hindsight, I don't know. I think I let them off too easy. But then again, I went for 4.5 years in my day. I switched my major and changed plans. So I don't know what the right answer is on that. But, some time frame should be there. So that is the concept of the bill, and I would certainly stand for any questions.
Any questions from members of the committee?
I rambled too long.
Madam Chair.
Senator
Gerlach, and perhaps this isn't meant to get into great detail, but what if, for instance, the student cycle drifted into a 6-year program? Would they click off, if you will, the tuition guarantee that this bill would give them?
Senator Gerlach.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, we're certainly drifting that direction, some could say now, into right. 4.5 years and such. I guess we'd have to really drill down to the rationale of why that is. I think some of it certainly is programs get dragged on. People have always been changing majors, doing those sorts of things. But certainly the cost has caused the length of time to go on. If people have to take on a full-time job, you can only go part-time and it takes longer, those sorts of things and such. The plan I have presented has 5 years in there. The notion is that, it gives you a certain set time frame. If you go beyond that, then it blinks off and you'd have to start again with a new cohort. There has to be some limitation. You can't let it go on forever. I think it's reasonable that there should be some limitation. Exactly what that is, I don't know, but 6 years seems long.
Senator Gerlach, I've heard of this being done, but it's both to guarantee tuition and to encourage timely graduation. So it's really for students who make an attempt or are successful. I'm not quite sure how it works in actually graduating in 4 years, but I can see where there could be some problems, though, if you did change majors and what would happen if you dropped out or you didn't complete in your 4 years, what happens to your guaranteed tuition rate. So it can get kind of complicated, it seems.
It could, Madam Chair, and I think that the institutions that have implemented this, they address a lot of those in their policies. What happens if you, for example, if you withdraw on your own volition, well, then the clock is still ticking. And you get back in, then, your guarantee has been running concurrently with that time. Uh-huh. Some institutions do that. Others allow escape valves. For example, if you are in the reserves or the guard and you're called to active duty, that would be an exemption, and your clock would freeze at that time, and you could pick up where you left off. For example, natural disasters. If this were to happen and you had a hurricane or a tornado and your plan or your program was dislocated in that sense through no fault of your own, then there are waivers granted. And the institutions have set up a review committee where you could make your case, and they could decide those on an individual case if you were doing that. But the idea also is not to be all things to all people in every case because of the wide variety and diversity of everybody's unique situations, but rather to go after the bulk of those individuals and offer the bulk of them some stability and predictability.
I could see you could also do a system where if they completed 1 year, they would get a rebate, or completion of 1 year, then you get a reduction in your tuition for your next year. I think there's lots of different ways you could structure that would both provide students with a guarantee and help with the graduation rate.
I agree, Madam Chair, and certainly those are the kind of details that should probably be left up to the institution. They're the experts in their student body and what are the individual cases.
Madam Chair. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There are a lot of the schools that have done this have done it on a voluntary basis, and so students were allowed to choose either the traditional tuition rates and plan to have increases every year, or they could opt for the one that would be the same across 5 years. And I don't know, I haven't seen studies indicating how many have chosen each of those, but it would be interesting to have some of our institutions try it.
Right. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chair Babbitt. I don't know if I'll be able to ask my question clearly, so hang in here with me a little bit. If a student, why wouldn't we just say that the systems need to set the tuition rate and that their increases ought to only be correlated with the Consumer Price Index.
That's Senator Rosen's bill.
Mm-hmm. which is Senator Rosen's bill. Okay, but for this bill, because my question is, the student that's coming in behind, I'm a student, I've purchased at $10 a credit, and I have a Consumer Price Index for my 4 or 5 years. The student behind me, the student that's the next group coming in, they may be started at a tuition rate of $30 a credit. And that's my guaranteed price through the next 4 or 5 years. And then the student behind that might be set at $50, if I understand this plan. So each student behind that's coming up is carrying a bigger share of the cost of the educational system. So that's the part of, I like the part of the time limit and the encouragement for completion, but that's the part of it that I have difficulty with, the implications of that for students following the first group of students.
Certainly address that.
Senator Gerlach.
Senator Pappison. And let me first say that it's unique me being at the table this time because we spent so much time in committee where I got to grill you.
it's nicer over here, I'll tell you.
if you'll think of this is the way I see it. If you'll think of it as there's a pivot point. Assuming you have a 4-year lock-in, you complete the first 2 years, you're going to pay a little more, but in the last 2 years, you pay a little less of what it would be. But it was predictable over 4 years, if you follow me. So, yes, you have particular cohorts paying more each year, but you have everybody paying more now anyway. But if you follow me, I don't even know if I can do this right. I don't have a chart or anything like that. But if you assume that, you know what, I'm not even going to attempt this because I'm going to get it wrong. The graphic is going to be wrong. But that's what the picture I'm trying to paint in your mind is that you're going to pay a little more on the front end, but you're going to pay less on the back end because you've spread it out over 4 years, kind of dollar cost averaging in a sense, where you've spread that out. And, yes, when you enter with the cohort, that's what you'll lock in. I don't know if there's a better way to answer that.
Okay, let's hear from Senator Rosen about her approach.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's truly a pleasure to be in front of your committee with Senate File 533, affectionately known as the Catch Your Breath bill. And for many of you, you're probably going to want to catch your breath around this table. I have 3 children, and 2 are in college. One is graduating at the end of March, a trimester early, because of the Talented Math Youth Program. So thank you very much, Madam Chair, for that. And big cost savings there.
She's
I am. I'm very proud of this young man.
Oh, but he's in how many years has he been in that program?
Well, all through high school. He was the last one in his senior year in high school to graduate with that. So he's
and then did it get discontinued?
No. Oh. He's graduating from college now.
Okay.
A semester early. Because
I'm sorry,
program.
I just missed the beginning of what you said. My middle daughter was also in the Talented Youth Program, so I'd lost track. I didn't maybe...
Oh,
it wasn't
okay.
Still happening.
Well,
but,
yes. The point I want to make is I have one more to go. Mm-hmm. And ever since they were this little, Senator Michelle, we talked to them, and I'm sure you do this too, about not necessarily are you going to college, it's where you're going to college. So it's very nice to see that this room is packed because this is truly a big issue for many of our youth, and you have to start early thinking about this. Basically, Senate File 533 limits the tuition increase at the state colleges and the University of Minnesota to 3% for the next 2 years. And right now they're assumed that their 08-09 operating budget is projected at a 4% tuition increase. So we're just basically allowing the parents to also budget at 3%. And that is a huge, huge deal for a parent to say, okay, I know that my child is going to have just a 3% tuition increase. And I have figures here, Madam Chair and members, for the University of Minnesota and MinSCU, as far as their percentage of tuition increase over the last few years, I don't know if you've seen those figures, but starting in 2000, it ranged anywhere from 1% increase to 5% increase. One of the largest was in 2002 at a 13.5% increase at the U of M and a 10% increase at the MinSCU, and that was before our budget crisis. And so we've had some hefty tuition increases. In 2005, 12.8% increase at the University of Minnesota, and 12.9 at Minsku. So as you can tell, we've got some double-digit tuition increases here. And although the state aid was cut in 03 to solve our $4.5 billion budget crisis, we have returned a lot of that aid back, or a lot of that aid has been restored. And the basic premise of this bill is tuition increases should be kept in line with what's taking place in the general economy. And I don't know if they really have. And that's a problem for these parents, a problem for these students. Certainly costs have increased, their fixed costs have increased at these tuitions or at these institutions, and we're just basically asking for them to look at their cost and budget like we are out there to try to send our kids to school. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm open to any questions. I think it's a fair proposal. I'm not sure how the institutions are going to feel about that, but and there is something, too, I want to bring up on the bill. As you can see on line 1.8 or 1.7, it says Minsku may not increase increase tuition in 07-08 and 08-09 more than 3%. But for the University of Minnesota, they're encouraged to limit tuition increases. And apparently I've been told that that has something to do with the state constitution and it being a land grant before. Right. So that's why there is a difference in those two paragraphs.
Encouraged. Right. Any questions for Senator Rosen? Yes, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, the biggest concern I have about any kind of a tuition cap is not knowing what the legislature is going to do in terms of appropriations for higher education in any given year. The most significant reason, if not the entire reason, why there were very large tuition increases from 2003 until today is because the legislature cut $400 million out of Minsku and the University of Minnesota's appropriations just in the 03 budget cycle, just for that two-year biennium. And I think one of the reasons that the legislature did that was because they are one of the few places in the budget that has another place they can go to make up for cuts, to wit, the students. So my concern would be if we institute any kind of a cap without any kind of concomitant guarantee that the legislature is going to fund them with enough money so they don't have to increase tuition to keep the programs and services running, that it ends up being self-defeating. Students will pay less, and they will, in fact, get less for their money. How would you handle that conundrum in your
poll? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Lass, I certainly understand that. However, if you look at the governor's budget proposal, for the U of M, it's a 15% increase over the 06-07 budget. 15% increase is higher than any tuition increase we've seen in the last 6 years. And it's a 12% increase over the forecast base. So they are projected in the governor's budget, $153 million. Minsku is a 10% increase for both 06-07 and the forecast base, and they're projected at $123 million. So clearly, and you know, you went through that budget crisis along with all of us here at this table, and it was our constitutional right to make sure that K-12 and law enforcement was taken care of. So higher ed was the brunt of a lot of those budget cuts, along with health and human services. But we are now able to project and perhaps restore some of those cuts. And I think that a 3% tuition freeze for just 2 years is a fair argument that anybody who is looking to go to college can say, I can afford a 3% increase in my tuition for the next 4 years. If I stick to my books and I study hard, I know what my tuition cost is going to be.
Okay. We actually need to move on because we have someone who has a time commitment, but I did want to ask if there's anyone in the audience who wants to make any brief comments on the idea of tuition freeze or tuition guarantee. Russ? While Mr. Stanton is coming up, I wanted to announce that the author of The Viewpoint in the Pioneer Press this morning, Mr. Monty Butte, is with us. Monty, are you planning on testifying? No, he's just here.
I've gotten enough trouble already.
All right. But so I just, we have copies of that for the members to look at if you didn't see it this morning. Mr. Stanton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Russ Stanton, Interfaculty Organization, State University faculty. I think Senator Latz nailed our largest concern with this, in that there's unpredictable factors that affect the cost of education. Inflation is one of them, and I think the bill responds to that. The factor it does not respond to is the unpredictability of the legislature and state government. The reason why we had big spikes in tuition over the last 4 years was not because state spending or spending at the higher education institutions was greater. In fact, spending per student at the higher education institutions, even unadjusted for inflation, spending is down significantly per student at those institutions. What caused the tuition to spike was that the legislature cut $189 million out of the budget 4 years ago, and it left a hole. And the only way to fill that hole was to raise tuition on students. And, in fact, the budgets were predicated on raising student tuition 15%. So my fear is that if you gave a guarantee and then the legislature came along and did another big cut, where would you go to fill the hole? You would have to slice programs even deeper, and I'm afraid we're already our per student expenditures are about half that of the private sector. Cut it anymore, you're not being efficient anymore. You're just plain cutting programs. So that would be our biggest concern about the guarantee. If the legislature could guarantee that they'd keep their half up with inflation, we'd be all in favor of this.
Okay. Any questions from Mr. Stanton?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And this isn't particularly for Mr. Stanton, but when President Brunix was in here, and I didn't quite understand his answer, but he indicated that the inflationary costs in higher ed are 7 to 8% annually instead of tied to the CPI. And I still don't exactly understand why that would be, when I do believe that about 80% of the costs are salary related. And so I'm still struggling with that. So it is kind of good to hear Mr. Stanton say that if we matched a 3% inflationary increase, as well as a tuition increase going up 3%, that maybe would take care of it.
Mr. Stanton.
Certainly that would take care of keeping pace with inflation. I want to, we're pretty sensitive to this idea that salaries are driving it. In the last 4 years, our salary increases compounded over those 4 years were 11%. Student increases were 54%. We'll take the 11%, by the way, is lower than the CPI. How much the CPI increased during those years. So we'll take credit for the 11%, but don't blame us for the 54%, the remainder of it. To tell you the truth, I don't know where that figure of the higher education price index going up faster. Perhaps it's different at the U than it is for us. I can tell you, after 4 years of no inflation, we'd be tickled pink with the CPI.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any motions on these bills?
Do we want to leave them?
Senator Roebling.
I would move that Senate Trial 533 be laid over for consideration in the omnibus higher ed bill.
Okay, any questions, discussion on 533? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I don't know how to do this. I know that Senator Gerlach's bill is very, very similar. I think there might be a couple words different with Senator Day's bill. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if we want to move just one or the other of those to lay it over. Should we just lay both of them over for consideration?
Why don't you do both?
Okay. Madam Chair, then I would move that Senate File 598 and 456 be laid over for consideration in the omnibus higher education bill.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, there is one additional one. 232 was the other one. But I'd be remiss with my commitment to Representative Biskins if I didn't ask that one to be moved for possible consideration as well.
Madam Chair. I would move that Senate File 232 be laid over for consideration in the omnibus higher ed bill. I believe that there are some differences, but that he asked the institutions to incorporate the inflation in the five year adjustment right away, so it isn't added on to whatever the average is when they start out. So it doesn't include a provision for inflation on top of the average. He expects them to incorporate the inflation into the average. But it is a slightly different concept.
Okay. I'm sorry. Are we done with this?
Oh, no, I just moved it.
Oh, you moved it. Yeah. Which one did you move?
232.
Okay. Senator Roebling moves that 232 be laid over for consideration for the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I'm sorry we're running a little late. We need to do Senate File 528, which is my bill.
So, Senator Pappas, welcome to the committee.
Is Mr. Sadowski still here? Oh, great. Come
on. Mr. Sadowski.
Good, I'm sorry. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 528 is asking Minscu to discontinue their non-resident tuition rates, and so that we would have a flat rate in the state of Minnesota. And the reason that I'm proposing this is really it's a workforce issue, that so many, first of all, many of our Minscu campuses already do charge a flat rate, and they tended to be more in the rural area or border campuses where they had a flat enrollment, and it was an attempt for them to beef up their enrollment. So they have been successful with that, as well as the Morris campus and I believe the Crookston campus of the University of Minnesota also charge a flat rate. So to ask Minscu campuses to go to a flat rate is a way for us to say as a state that we're really interested in having talent come to our state. We already do have quite a bit of talent that comes through reciprocity. And when kids come here and go to college in large numbers in the 60 to 70% range, they stay in the state of Minnesota because they find jobs here. Our own residents who go to Minnesota colleges stay in Minnesota after graduate at about an 80% rate. So it's not much lower for these out-of-state kids. We are facing an impending workforce shortage, and this is the issue I brought to Mr. Sandowski, who's from the Minnesota Chamber, and he chairs the Workforce and Education Committee. And we had a very interesting discussion of a couple hours about this whole issue of how do we attract talent to our state. And certainly there may be many more creative ways that we can look at this, but this is one idea that I have. So I'd like to have him comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, my name is Peter Sadowski. I work for a medical device company here in the Twin Cities, but I'm here today as chair of the Minnesota Chamber's Education and Workforce Development Policy Committee. The Minnesota Chamber supports SF 528 for two reasons. One is we see this as a way of attracting and retaining students, and we feel that this is one of the items to address an anticipated workforce shortage. So to the first point on attracting and retaining students, Minnesota business needs well-educated students. From a workforce standpoint, we want as many students to stay here or move here and then participate in Minnesota's post-secondary education. We see these students as keys to filling Minnesota jobs of the future. Students that attend post-secondary education here are likely to stay here, and that's why this is a contributor to an eventual workforce issue for the state. On the second point, which is anticipating the workforce shortage, this is something that Minnesota businesses are feeling today. In fact, I can tell you that we are right now in my business. So this is a real problem, and it's going to get worse. By 2010, the significant increase in demographics will be people in the over 65 demographic. And as these demographics continue to change, we're going to see an increased shortage in educated workforce at about the time that the economy of the state is going to demand more and more educated workforce. So therefore, we need to attract more students, and that will result in more educated workers. And this is necessary for maintaining the state's economic growth as it is today and to make it competitive going forward. Thank you.
And Stacia, did you want to say something?
I was just here to help with questions. I'm Stacia Smith with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just want to say real quickly, for any of you who are fairly new, which I don't see many new faces, but the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is the state's largest business organization. We represent over 2,600 companies. 80% of those are 100 or fewer, have 100 or fewer employees. And that's it. Thanks.
I was also asked to tell members that this was a concept and an idea that Governor Elmer Anderson was very supportive of.
Well, thank you, Senator Pavis. Are there any questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Tomassoni.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, I think this makes all the sense in the world. I've never really understood out-state tuition rates. I understand the theory behind them, but it seems to me that we should be encouraging people to come to Minnesota. And I know that there's a mishmash of different ways of approaching this in our college system, where some campuses don't charge out-state tuition, some do. So we're probably getting toward this bill anyway. And I even have been told that international students don't get charged out-state tuition. So I think that's a pretty interesting dynamic here in that you're probably onto something.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Tomassoni, in particular, I found out that at Winona State, the international students are charged resident tuition, and in exchange they're asked to do community service. So, you know, they add kind of a cultural diversity to the campus and also to the community that they're in. And we do have reciprocity with a lot of states now where we're only getting resident tuition.
Yep.
So, we did end up with a fiscal note. That's the first time I've seen a fiscal note on this. So we'll have to, you know, resolve this issue like we resolve all the other budget issues.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Pappas and I have had discussions about this, and I just wanted to bring it forward again, is somewhat my concern that if we have campuses that are filled to capacity and we have families from our own communities whose children can't get in because we are opening the doors that much wider, I'm just trying to figure out how to address that issue. I know some of our campuses do close enrollment applications at, you know, as early as December sometimes because they're filled, and some of them aren't filled at all. And in response, some of them have in the past done this, that they don't charge any non-resident tuition because they're trying to fill all of their seats and slots. But I still struggle with that idea. I don't want our families coming to us and saying that my children can't get in to the school of their choice, even though they have a 3.5 GPA and scored 24 on the ACT or something like that. And I'm just a little worried that at some of our state universities that could happen under this agreement.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
And we did look at some language that we thought might help. We didn't really come up with anything that was very satisfactory. So, Senator Roebling, I think you're right. This bill is kind of has contained within it the assumption that our college enrollment is declining and not increasing. And that's what it's projected to do. Now, of course, we want to help bring more kids who don't traditionally come from families where they've gone to college into college as well. So that's also a goal that we have. But it is under the assumption that we're not going to be filling those seats as much as we have in the past. But if that might be a concern at a particular institution, we certainly can look at flexibility, creating some flexibility in the law to deal with that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
You know, I wonder, thank you, Madam Chair, if just pure demographics might take care of some of Senator Roebling's concerns. You know, Senator Pappas talked about, you know, current projections, our number of college graduates is going down. Well, if you look at the K-12 system, the majority of our K-12 school districts also have declining enrollment. So I think that might, you know, just without doing anything, demographics, I think, are going to open up some more capacity. And we need to do what we can through this legislation and otherwise to be a welcoming place for higher education, no matter where these students start from, Minnesota, outstate, or out of the country. So I appreciate the effort. There's probably a lot more we need to be doing.
At our accountability workshop on Friday, we did get some information about having a shortage of college graduates. We're not graduating enough students to meet the workforce needs, and we are projected to have 2,000. I've heard anywhere from 2,000 a year to 125,000 over a period of years. So it is going to be a serious issue for us.
Senator Pappas, I would like to ask a question that Senator Roebling may have been asking. It's what I understood from it, to just a little more clarity. With a flat rate, regardless of where the person is coming from, supported by Minnesota taxpayers, is there a concern, even if we have declining enrollment, that the children of families from Minnesota are competing with students from a very large geographic area worldwide and can't get into the university on a competitive basis with this? Is it possible to have within the institutions or other regulations that oppose some other criteria for selection that would allow some point system, for example, besides GPA, to allow allow for a differential in who is applying?
Madam Chair, yes, that's what we were talking about, is some way to guarantee that Minnesota residents are still going to be able to get their kids in college. But I do think that we have a very strong ego in Minnesota. I mean, we think that we're the best and we have all the best institutions. And as we're seeing, that has slipped. So I don't know that I think that we're going to be in such demand internationally, let alone nationally. There certainly are some colleges maybe that will happen with that are star colleges. But remember, we still have the weather to deal with in Minnesota. And I know that it's very hard often, employers tell me, to recruit people to come to Minnesota because of the weather. But once they're here, they don't want to leave. So our idea is to get the students to come here, and then we think they won't want to leave. But I don't think we're going to be deluged with tons of students from all over the place. But we'll go cautiously. You know, we'll try to come up with some. If we decide to incorporate this bill, we'll try to come up with some language to make sure that doesn't happen.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Another idea that I was floating was that we could have the institutions set different deadlines so that Minnesota students, for example, would have a December 1st deadline, and all of those who would meet the criteria of that institution would be admitted at that time, and then there would be a January 1st or January 15th deadline, and then they would be able to accept other students that would meet their criteria from wherever.
Simple idea.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Pappas. Is there any other questions? Would you like to make a motion?
Madam Chair, unless there's someone else who wants to testify.
Is there someone in the audience that would like to testify on this Senate file? Seeing no one.
I'd move that Senate file 528 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? passes. Do you want to proceed with your next bill right away?
Madam Chair, I would like us to actually recess the funding division and move to the policy committee, which is going to take up the DREAM Act, because the students have to go back to school, many of them. So we need to take up that bill next.
So we will convene as a policy committee. And
so if you would just declare the funding division to be in recess.
The funding division is in recess.
And convene the policy committee.
I'm now convening the policy committee. Thank you very much. And now we will be hearing Senate File 653.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 653 has been before this committee several times in the past few years and has been incorporated into the omnibus bill. For new members, though, we thought that we would like to hear from some testifiers and have another discussion to see if there's any maybe new information. The crux of the bill is that it says that any student who will qualify for resident tuition rate if they attend high school in Minnesota for 3 years and have graduated from Minnesota, if they're accepted into a public institution, and if that student is not a citizen or permanent resident, then they have to file an affidavit saying that they will become a permanent resident at the earliest opportunity that they're allowed to. And briefly, that will, I guess I, because they're on a time crunch, I'd just like us to move to the students. Oh, the new one.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Will you be introducing your speakers?
Yes, why don't we take the students first, then, and then we can take the professors after that. Maria Lemus from Harding. Why don't you come up? And Juventino Meza from Arlington, and Denise Soriano from Chaska. You have another chair. You take the chair on the end. Oh, we got this one. Great. Did you have a chair? All right. Why don't you come sit down with me, all of you?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Senjum.
I will defer, but if I could, could I ask Senator Pappas a question on the bill, which the students may not be familiar with in terms of the answer. Generally speaking, on lines 19 and 20, where we talk about becoming a permanent resident at the earliest opportunity, individual is eligible to do that, to do so. What really does that, is that an age factor or a time in the country factor or?
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, that's a federal government factor. When the federal government reforms immigration laws so that students like these have a path to permanent residency, it would be at that point. Because right now, because their parents aren't documented, they have no path, no way to do that.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, at this point, that we can't really answer that question because the federal government hasn't acted. Is that right?
That's right.
Senator Pappas.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Who is Maria? Okay. I'm going to go first.
Okay. Senators and Madam's Chair.
Did you say your name? Would you give us your name?
Oh, sure.
Yes, thank you.
My name is Maria. And I am 16 years old, girl from Latin America. I am here with my mother because I want to survive, have a better life, help my mother and brothers. I want to have a career. My father died 7 years ago. I have 5 brothers and 2 nephews still living in Latin America. I miss them a lot. My 9 years old sister lives with my grandmother, and my 3 young brothers live alone. I'm an excellent student with excellent grades. My dream is to go to college after high school so I can work and have a career. I hope they can pass the DREAM Act so I can go to college and pay the same cost that American students pay. I hope to become a resident in this country so that I can visit my brothers. The debate over immigration is very important because many people who come here leave their sons and families behind in hopes of supporting them in their daily survival. Many parents whose children are born here become separate if they are deported. They live here in fear because they can be deported at any time. Some die without ever seeing their children again. Please support the DREAM Act. We are the change that you would like to have in this country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maria. Would you say your last name for the record?
My last name is Lemus. Limos.
Limos. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Senator Pappas?
Yeah. Who's going to next? Denise? Yeah. Okay, you're Denise.
Okay. Be sure to say your name, your full name, please.
My name is Juventino Mesa. Thank you, Madam and Senators. I migrated from Mexico to the United States when I was 15 years old. Since then, I have attended Arlington High School, where I started as an English language learner student. Absorbing all I could from my teacher was really hard because I barely spoke English. Despite all of these barriers and hardships, I will graduate from Arlington High School after 4 high school academic awards and having survived 10 years of family separation. I have demonstrated that I am capable of doing a great job in the community just like any of my classmates. My starting school was not easy, but my teachers corroborated that I had the potential of a responsible student. My teachers have always been my inspiration. This is why I want to become a secondary teacher so I can give back to my community and support future students. Adapting to my new life was not easy either, but I worked really hard, just like the hundreds of new Minnesotans who now make up the rich cultural and economic fabric of our state. Education in our native nations is a privilege, not a choice. Other things become before education, such as work. Therefore, when our parents brought us here, they did it with the purpose of giving us a better life. I am sure that education was integrated in that purpose. As immigrants, we represent the old generations who came before us, like the Germans, the Scottish, the British, and others. Your forefathers created this nation based on the attributes offered by newcomers. I believe education played a huge role in their lives, for it is because of them we have such great institutions in this state. Let the Minnesota Dream Act become a law, for if it does not, we young and talented students are more likely to drop out of high school at a young age. Those of you who do not believe in us, I will tell you that we are better in school, doing great things than out there on the streets causing trouble. Let us not fall into the class of destruction. As an immigrant, I am a bilingual student, and I can contribute to this society just as much as the next citizen. For the past 3 years and a half now, I have volunteered on a regular basis for the community that embraced me since my arrival to Minnesota. But I am willing to give much more once I become a college graduate and fulfill my potential. I believe that it is because of immigrants this nation rose to the top. This nation needs our labor and our minds for the long run. I deserve equal opportunity to higher education as any other Minnesotan. Lady Liberty still stands as a symbol of greatness, freedom, hope, and perseverance. All of the attributes new young Minnesotans, students like me, have to offer this state. Come to Arlington High School. Let me show you how amazing we can be if granted the right chance. Just give us a chance. Thank you.
Thank you.
We were supposed to be at Arlington High School tomorrow night for our hearing, but we ended up having a conflict at the building. They couldn't accommodate us. But we wanted to come to your high school.
Madam Chair, Senators, hello. My name is Denise Soriano. I am 15 years old. I am a sophomore at Chaska High School. I am a hardworking student. I am a proud single mother. I am the American dream. My dream is to graduate from college and then go on to medical school. I want to become an OBGYN ever since I had my daughter. The reason I am here today is because I want the DREAM Act to be passed. What is the DREAM Act? Equal rights for higher education. No more, no less. I want to go on to college, not just for me, but also for my daughter. I want her to have a better life than I did, also for her to have opportunities for success in life. I ask myself every day, how come I have to pay out of school tuition? I have lived here practically all my life, ever since I was 5 months old. I have always gone to school and earned good grades. I know how to speak and write English just like everyone else. I can't afford college. My family makes less than the average income. How am I supposed to pay for college if I have to pay more because I am undocumented? When people come to the U.S., they think their children will have better education. We're not asking you to pay for college, but to change the out-of-state tuition. Because I can't even apply for federal, state, financial aid, or most scholarships. If you could please help pass the DREAM Act, you would not only help me, but also the thousands, even millions of undocumented people. I have dreamed to succeed. I have dreams to succeed in life and go to college. This is my dream. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Just wanted to see if there are any questions for the students.
Any questions for the students from the senators?
Sure.
Senator Tomasoni.
I'm sorry, what was your name?
Denise Soriano.
No, his name.
Sorry.
Juventino.
How old are you?
I'm 19.
You're 19, and you graduated from high school?
I'm going to graduate this year. I'm a senior.
And when you were 15, you didn't speak any English?
I did not.
Outstanding.
Senator Wirken.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, students. Would you like to share what your career dream might be someday?
All of you, each of you, yeah.
Oh. I want to be a teacher, actually an ESL teacher. I know what I went through for the first 2 years, so I want to make it more easy for those who are coming after me.
I want to be an obstetrician.
I want to be a dentist.
Mm. And Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know, and I'm a co-author on this bill, but I want to remind you students and all of those present in the room that Minnesota can only give you part of your dream, and that we might be able to help you with your education, but we can't help you on the path to citizenship. That has to be done at the federal level. And so I want to encourage you to continue to pursue the Federal DREAM Act, which would provide similar educational opportunities, but would also provide you a path to citizenship and the work documentation that you will also need after you have your degree. So this is only one of the steps, and you have to continue to work on that effort as well.
Thank you, Senator Roebling. Would anyone like to respond?
I think that if we become college graduate, we'll have a better chance to become citizens or documented and later on citizens. So just by having a degree, it's just a better chance for us to one day become U.S. citizens.
Because we need an educated workforce. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Okay, Madam Chair, maybe we could move on, and I'd like to thank the students very much for testifying today. You did a great job.
Senator Senjum?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, may I ask a question of Senate counsel on, may I?
Okay. Yes, you may.
on line 19, where it talks about becoming a permanent resident. Is a permanent resident, is that a legal term different than a citizen?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not an expert on this, but I believe it is a different term. It's a status that's granted under the immigration laws, but I'm not an expert on the immigration laws. But it is a status.
Okay.
It's recognized.
Is there someone else who wants to speak to this issue?
I have Professor Kathy Fennelly from the University of Minnesota, who's an immigration law professor, and she can address any questions like that, plus she has some testimony, too.
Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and distinguished senators. A legal permanent resident is a term that's used by the Immigration Customs Enforcement Service. And it is not a citizen, but you have the rights of permanent residence, somewhat short of citizenship, but you have the right to work in the country and to live in the U.S. also called an LPR sometimes in the acronym.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tamassani.
As long as you're at the table, explain to us how these young students would become citizens of the United States now.
With the current immigration law, there is almost no chance that these young people will be able to become citizens. That's why, as Senator Pappas mentioned, Senator Boak, it's imperative that there be lobbying for federal changes, because it's the federal government that controls immigration law right now. We have a system where there are some employment-based visas that are granted to individuals who want to come and work in the United States. The 99% of those employment-based visas are granted to people who are high-skilled workers. So if people come, as many, certainly not all, but many persons come from Latin America to work here in low-skilled jobs in hospitality and construction and horticulture and agriculture and so on, only one out of 100 of those applicants will be admitted with the permission to become go onto a path for legal permanent residence. And so what happens is we have jobs, recruitment, and a shortage of persons in the 25 to 44 age range for working, young workers, and therefore people come in, they enter without authorization, they're undocumented, and under current law, there is essentially no way for them to become authorized.
And Madam Chair, that's because they're undocumented?
That's right.
And is there still the five-year naturalization process in place in the United States for documented people or no?
Naturalization for people who are legal permanent residents certainly is in place. But people who come in who are sometimes called unauthorized, sometimes called undocumented, sometimes referred to in the press as illegal, those individuals have almost no opportunity to become legal permanent residents while in the U.S. So these young people under current immigration law don't have that opportunity.
And one last question that I'm not understanding.
We just had
a witness who said she's been in the United States since she's 5 months old. Mm-hmm. How does she stay undocumented?
Well, we have 11 million people in the United States today, an estimated 11 million who are here without authorization, who are undocumented. And so we've not had enforcement of the laws that are on the books with some recent exceptions, to arrest and deport people who are here without authorization.
Except, Madam Chair, if we've got somebody going to school in our school system from the time that she's in kindergarten, we have to have some kind of documentation. I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, the schools do not require proof of legal permanent residence. And so, in fact, you can be here from the time you were just a few days old if you cross the border at that point. So that we have 11 million people who are living in this country without authorization, and that demonstrates, I think, how badly broken the federal immigration system is, particularly since we rely upon these people, and we have young people like the ones who testified today.
In school, do they have to present a birth certificate?
No.
Oh. That's not our legislation. I thought you did. Okay, you want to give your regular testimony?
Okay. I'm Catherine Fennelly. I'm professor of public policy. I'm not an attorney, my work and my research and teaching is all on immigration and public policy, particularly interested in policies that will promote the integration of immigrants regardless of their immigration status. I have a handout, which is a two-page handout that has the date at the top, 22707, and has a figure on the second page. And what I'd like to do, Madam Chair.
Does everyone have that? Oh, okay.
It's got my name. It has testimony on SF 653 and then my name underneath, Catherine Fennelly. We are rightly proud of the fact that Minnesota is among the top five states in overall graduation rates, high school graduation rates. And we have certainly seen articles in the press about this. We should not be, of course, at all proud of the fact that we have one of the worst records in the country in terms of Latino graduation rates for a number of reasons that are beyond the scope of today's discussion. But the disparities are quite striking. 87% of white 10th graders in Minnesota go on to graduate, compared to only 61% of 10th graders who are Latino youth. Now, the reason that I bring this up is because when we have young people who are Latinos. They're not all undocumented individuals are Latino, but many are. When we have young people like the ones who testified today, like so many who are in the hearing room today, who in fact are in school, are staying in school, are earning good grades, who are about to graduate and whose aspiration is to go on to college, then I would like to suggest that what we should be thinking about is ways to reward these young people as role models, as people who would like to be dentists and obstetricians and other professionals. But in fact, what we have at the moment with the differences in tuition rates is a barrier to their going on to college at all. Another reason why I think this is deserving of particular attention is if you look at the graph on the second page, what you'll see is that these young people are the future of Minnesota. And that's not hyperbole. What I've got in this graph is the percent change in enrollment for white students and non-white students in Minnesota between the years 2001 and 2005. And what you can see is that when it says student density, that's looking at whether these are rural, from rural to urban school districts. So that's looking at density or numbers of students per square mile. So what you can see is that in every single category on the left here, the white student enrollment is decreasing or decreased during that period in Minnesota. And in every single rural to urban category with the dark blue bars on the right, non-white enrollment, particularly Latino enrollment, increased very dramatically. So when we are doing projections and look at future enrollment in Minnesota schools, we're looking at increasingly large percentages of Latino youth. And because a substantial proportion of Latinos are in the state working in low-skilled jobs for which there aren't visas, employment-based visas, and the opportunity to be here as a legal permanent resident, we have a large number of these young people who may themselves be unauthorized if they weren't born here. So it's a conundrum that I think greatly affects the future of Minnesota and the future workforce. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Fennelly. Are there others who would like to testify, Senator Pappas?
I apologize for calling you a lawyer.
Before you leave, maybe I'll ask Ms. Fennelly, before you leave, maybe I'll ask, make sure that is there anyone who would like to ask a question of Ms. Fennelly?
I don't know.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Then we have Stacia Smith back from the Minnesota Chamber.
Welcome, Stacia.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, again. I've had the pleasure of working on this with Senator Pappas for now 2 years. Again, I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I'm speaking in support of Senate File 653 regarding resident tuition rate requirements. The reasons why we're supporting this are very similar to the flat tuition bill that we were up here for before, Senate File 528. And the first thing is that we just need an educated and trained workforce. From an employer standpoint, many businesses require that job seekers have some kind of post-secondary experience. And the business community needs workers with post-secondary education to support business as usual, day-to-day, right now. And as companies look to companies look at workforce as a key indicator as to whether or not to expand here or relocate here in Minnesota. The second thing is demographics. And as we've heard already today, I don't need to reiterate it, the demographics are shifting, and we will need we will be in dire need for more educated workers in the future. And with that, I'd just like to give my support and answer any questions. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Seeing none, Senator Pappas.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And then last, we have Professor Bruce Corey from Concordia University.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, thanks for the opportunity to be here. I'm wearing two hats, too. Part of a multi-ethnic coalition called OneMinnesota.org, that the goal is to create one Minnesota where everybody has an equal chance, an equal opportunity to be full participants in the state. And one of the agenda items that we are supporting is the need to have universal education and good quality education for all. We need a paradigm shift. Very much like as an economist, we study GDP, which is a measure of wealth of the country, regardless of whether it's the Japanese or British or Dutch who produce in our country. We've got to look at the same way at education.
Thank you.
That whoever is in the state regardless of location, identity, or economic status, they are our human capital, and their productivity is very critical for us to remain competitive in this global world. And so it requires an investment on our part. In the President Economic Report of the President in 2006, and I have a lot of data here, which I won't get into, but for your reference, studies show that a third of the economic growth in the country is tied towards productivity. So when you look at whether it's an individual firm or the nation, education and human capital investment are so important, and it's important not to distinguish who is in this pool of human capital, but make sure that we invest in everybody because they are the ones who are the dentist, the computer programmer, or somebody doing some ordinary work, and the quality of the work will matter because we also know that we are competing in this global world where our skill levels are not as competitive. We don't want to create a big pool of low-skilled workers that might be the likely case if people drop out from school. If you were to put some numbers at the back to the testimony that was given by Maria, for instance, that you could see that there's big differences and big returns to public investment on the last page from the RAND study that came across. If you have the case of a native-born Mexican female who graduates from high school or who has some college or goes to college, big returns on investment in public education and in their own lives. And lastly, a lot of immigrants who are in Minnesota, and you can see more documentation on this on my site, ethnictrends.info. A lot of Minnesota's immigrants contribute in five big ways to our state. As consumers, minorities have a buying power of over $12 billion that's greater than the GDP of 90 countries in the world. If you go to Lake Street on University Avenue, you can see the entrepreneurial talent as well as in the high-tech areas. In workers, not only are people food processors, but they are also doctors and physicians and college professors like me. And they add to the cultural capital of the state and trade networks. We talked about trade missions going to China, going to India, and you've seen the connection between the local communities and the global community. And Bill Gates stole my thunder this morning in the Pioneer Press or in the Wall Street Journal. He had an editorial in a very similar way. He said, innovators, we should welcome innovators to the country regardless of where they're coming from. And he makes a very good case there. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Or are there any questions from the senators? Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, you might ask if there's anyone else who wants to testify.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify that is here today? Seeing no one.
Then, Madam Chair, I would move
Senator Senjum. Excuse me, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, a question you probably thought about, and it was prompted by the chamber witness. If as it is, we're going to be looking at a state and on into the future that is desperately in need of employees and skilled and educated employees, why do we even have resident and non-resident tuition? Why just don't we break that barrier down and have a tuition and invite all to come to Minnesota for their education?
Senator
Isn't
Pappas.
There some attractiveness to do that?
Yep, Madam Chair, he wasn't. I think
he
stepped out of the room.
Oh.
Give him a break.
It's okay. It's okay.
Senator
Pappas. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I wish I had room in my bill to put you on. You are on my bill. Here he is. Senate File 528, you're a co-author, Senator Senjum, of a bill we just recommended for inclusion in the consideration for inclusion.
Oh, you're such a good idea.
Well, we took care of that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. You just missed that. Hearing what you already knew was a great idea.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the questioning and the comments, particularly from Senator Senjum and Senator Tomasoni. I guess my level of frustration with the federal government continues to rise as you hear the witnesses for this bill. I appreciate Senator Pappas sticking with it. And this should be the year. This should be the year for this legislation. I know we have some work to do together.
One with, big barrier.
With the House and with the administration, but I appreciate you sticking with it, and this is the future. You know, Minnesota is not going to be just a bunch of Norwegians and Swedes, and that's okay. That's okay. There's nothing to be afraid of. And we're going to need everyone in this room and more to take care of us and the baby boomers as we retire. So let's keep plugging away.
Thank you, Senator Michelle. Are there any other questions for Senator Pappas? Okay. Would you like to make a motion?
Madam Chair, I'd move that Senate File 653 be recommended to pass. And this can actually go to the floor.
This can go directly to the floor. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Hearing none.
All right. Close to the floor. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, why don't you just adjourn the policy committee and reconvene the funding division?
And I'm doing just exactly as Senator Pappas recommended.
We got Tomasoni.
Can we get overtime?
Nice time in life.
Are we overtime?
Nice time, yeah.
Thank you. That's coming to my office in a few
minutes. That's okay. That's okay. Is that great? But he has a sense of humor.
Yeah, we're teachers, when they talk about that.
Shouldn't be every year. Should be one more year.
No. Right, we have a left, I think. Thank you. Okay, if people would quietly leave the room, I'd appreciate it. I know you're all excited, but try to leave quietly. Then the funding division is reconvened, and Senator Tomasoni, what's 773.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, and nice job, Senator Pappas, on those last two bills.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senate File 773 is an appropriations bill which is aimed at keeping tuition at a zero increase over the next 2 years. And, Madam Chair, I've been on this kick for a little while now, and the reason for it is that tuition has been skyrocketing and has been getting out of hand in our universities. And, in fact, I think, if I'm not mistaken, our two-year colleges are the second most expensive in the country right now. And we've had a kind of an interesting history getting to where we're at right now because of the fact that just as recently as 2001, the state's share of tuition was 67%, and the student's share was 33%. And since that time, we've experienced tuition increases as high as 70% in the Minsky system and as high as 80% in the University of Minnesota system. And the state's share is now at 51%, and the student's share is at 49%. And, in fact, during the 2003 legislative session, there was a funding cut to the Minsky system of $191 million, and the students were forced to make up $173 million of it. And so at some point in time here, I think we've got to figure out a way to get a handle on this skyrocketing tuition and make college affordable for our students. Many of them are graduating with huge amounts of debt, and I'm worried, and I'm sure many of them are, that when they get out of college that they have a mortgage to pay, but they don't own a home. And in addition, paying off that student debt may take as long as 20 years, in which time they will be thinking about sending their own kids to college, and they haven't even paid off their own loans yet. So I think at some point in time we need to address the problem of the high cost of tuition. And I've got some witnesses, Madam Chair, who would like to give their own personal experiences and what's going on in the colleges that they are attending.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Scott Formo, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association. As you may recall from my previous testimony here in front of you, as well as some of the facts that Senator Tomasoni also just stated, Minnesota's two-year public colleges are now ranked second highest in the nation when it comes to tuition and fees, and that students have been facing skyrocketing tuition rates ever since 2003 when the $191 million was cut from the Minsky's appropriations. The last time I was here in front of you to speak, I talked about some of the choices that you have before you and some of the options that are available to fully fund the greatly needed tuition freeze at our colleges and universities. If you recall from the governor's proposal, I addressed the Achieve 2 program and the 3-hour high school program, both of which combined our ongoing appropriations of $167 million that target traditional students fresh from high school who, according to the OHE's 2007 report on higher education performance Minnesota measures, which is a book you got at, I believe, your last committee meeting, only make up 34.1% of the post-secondary students. The question that I ask of you here today is, what about the other 65.1% of post-secondary students who make up what I referred to as the average Minsky student? We need some relief for them also. I stand by my earlier statements to this committee when I say the best form of financial aid is lower tuition at our open access public institutions for everybody. I'm here today in support of Senate File 773, which allows for a fully funded 2-year tuition freeze and funds inflation for the system, but at the same time does not limit the choices and direction of the Minsky Board of Trustees or force our colleges to face program cuts. While the other bills you heard about here today all have good aspects to them, none of them take care of the tuition problem, especially at our 2-year colleges that we're facing today. Students today are struggling to stay in college because in today's job market, the rising student debt is fast outgrowing the economic benefits of pursuing a college degree and is outpricing many before they even get to the door. It's time to put a halt to the rising tuition for the next 2 years, which will allow Minsky and the state of Minnesota to work on some long-range plans of stability and predictability to correct this growing dilemma. As Senator Wieger said earlier today, tuition and fees are only part of what students are paying for. Senator Pappas, earlier today, when you were doing the math, you noted the $500 shortfall for a student who may be eligible for all the grants, but that's not including the hidden costs of the higher education, such as textbooks or required laptop leases, which you also heard about. We need to make a strong stance this year to curtail the problem, and by taking the first step in supporting Senator Tomasoni's bill, you can do just that. I urge you strongly to support this legislation as you move forward in addressing the concerns that students have brought to your attention, not only on the campaign trail, but also here at the Capitol, since this legislative session has started. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Formo. And Mr. McMartin?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Justin McMartin. I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. I'll be brief. I would like to address kind of some of the bills that were talked about earlier today. They recognize the problem in our higher education system in Minnesota, that the costs are becoming out of control for our students. You know, we've testified in front of this committee before. We've brought students in who have talked about the mounting debt and how they've accumulated that debt. And a significant portion of that is the significant cost of tuition at our state universities. What this bill does is it not only recognizes it, it also addresses it. As Senator Latt said earlier, you have to look at where that core problem is. And it's in our funding of our state higher education, of our public colleges and universities. And this bill does that. It pays for it, too. And that's why I'd really hope and urge all of you today to support this and to move it on to that next level. Because those earlier bills, they recognize the problem, but they don't address that core issue, that we're not paying for our public higher education in Minnesota. And I think that's what the main point I want to get across today is that I appreciate all the talk about higher education. It's obviously a huge issue. Otherwise, we wouldn't have six different bills trying to address this problem. But I think that the core problem is addressed in this bill by being able to pay for our public higher education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions, Senator Tomasoni?
I'm sure I just got a note from Mr. Spano, and it says in his program in Duluth, mastery of
advocacy, and political leadership. The average student comes to them with an average debt of $29,000, and they've got 585 students from all over Minnesota. And that's just an example of what's going on.
They start graduate school with that.
Yeah, exactly.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I just wanted to comment that earlier today when Senator Gerlach was here with a number of his bills, one of the things that he said really struck me, and he talked about the conversation really needs to center around how much needs to be legislated and how much needs to be the responsibility of the institution. I couldn't agree more with a student who just spoke and said that. What this bill does is really gets to the root cause. Mm-hmm. And I am supportive of this bill in particular because I think that it most clearly seeks to address the state's statutory obligation to fund higher education to the tune of 67% is currently in statute, and we have certainly fall short of that, and I appreciate Senator Tomasoni bringing this forward.
And Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Lynch. And I actually did some work to find out how much it would take to get us back to 67.33 in this next biennium, and it's a really, really big number. And so,
do share, Senator.
Well, it's $408 million for both the University of Minnesota and the Minsky system in 2008, and almost $600 million in 2009. So they're very, very big numbers. So hopefully we can at least slow it down here and slowly move back to where we were at.
Senator Tomasoni, you had been very proud with me at a meeting with the majority leader this morning. He said, well, you know, what is your vision for higher education? I said, I'd kind of like to get back to that 67.33.
I'm proud of you, Senator.
And he
Pappas.
Said, well, how much would that cost? And I said, $1 billion.
Whoa.
I said, well, you know, we were there 6-7 years ago. We were there. We can get back there in another 6-7 years. Just phase it in.
You hit it just about on the head, too.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I agree completely that's the direction we ought to be going. If we don't, certainly if we start reversing the reversal that we started, we're heading in the right direction now. But if we go back in the other direction, we're really more of a private system with some public funding than we are a truly publicly funded institution. And that's not appropriate in my book for these magnificent institutions of higher learning. This is the way I would rather go to see tuition kept down. If the state, as a matter of public policy, wants to keep tuition down, then we ought to put our money where our mouth is rather than tying the hands of the institutions themselves with regard to how they handle their finances and their tuition rates. So I think let's make it a priority. Then we can fund it.
So, Madam Chair, should I make a motion?
Sure.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 773 be laid on the table and be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus education.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Senator Tomasoni. For members who weren't here earlier, I just want to remind you that we have a hearing tomorrow night at the Rondo Community Center from 6:30 to 8:30, and you should have been given instructions. It's not that far from the Capitol. And did we find out what door we go in? The west door?
Or the one by the parking lot.
Right. Okay, so you go into, it's at Concordia and Dale. And the parking lot is to the left, and then it's the door by the parking lot. You go in the blue door, I believe. And also, if anyone is interested in going to the President Brunick State of the University event, we are going to adjourn at 2:30 on Thursday. And so I suggest people carpool, and if you're interested, we can get you a parking sticker. Okay, thank you. Meeting's adjourned. Oh, Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, is there a meeting Friday?
Yes, Friday morning. There's a meeting Friday morning. That's on the schedule as of right now. Is your committee meeting Friday morning? You're meeting all the time.
There's quite a few different.
There's quite a few different committees.
Subjects to be.
You know, with Ms. Ryan not here, I really can't remember. I think it was rollover from Thursday. What we didn't get done on Thursday.
Thank you.
Yeah. Reciprocity. I'm not sure what else.
Thank you.
Okay. Meeting's adjourned.